Blog Talk Radio.
And so now I'd like to say, people can change anything they want to. And that means everything in the world. People are running about following their little tracks. I am one of them. But we've all got to stop just following our own little mouse trail. People can do anything. This is something that I'm beginning to learn. People are out there doing bad things to each other. It's because they've been dehumanized. It's time to take the humanity back into the center of the ring and follow that for a time. Greed, it ain't going anywhere. They should have that in a big billboard across Times Square. Without people, you're nothing.
I have excellent news for the world. There's no such thing as New Wave. It does not exist. It's a figment of lame Kant's imagination. There was never any such thing as New Wave. It was the polite thing to say when you were trying to explain you were not into the boring old rock and roll, but you didn't dare to say punk because you were afraid to get kicked out of the fucking party and they wouldn't give you coke anymore. There's new music, there's new underground sound, there's noise, there's punk, there's power pop, there's ska, there's rockabilly, but new wave doesn't mean shit.
Yeah, I'm here, man. The lights are growing dim. I know a life of crime led me to this sorry fate. And yet, I blame society. Society made me what I am.
That's bullshit. You're a white suburban punk, just like me.
But it...
You're gonna be all right, man.
Maybe not.
McGee's back room, proudly broadcasting on the Fightin' Words Radio Network. Tonight, very special guest, probably one of the biggest guests in my book, who has agreed to come on the show, checking into McGee's back room tonight, is producer, recorder, engineer, guitarist, singer, and music-aholic Jack Endino. Perhaps best known for, well, I mean, the guy basically is, you know, if you grew up listening to, you know, the stuff coming out of Seattle in the late 80s, or were a subscriber to the first round of the Sub Pop Singles Club, you're familiar with his work. He's recorded bands such as Soundgarden, Nirvana, The Fluid, and that just scratches the surface. Guy's made 400 records, more than 400 records in his day, and he is going to be checking in with us probably in about 20 minutes from now. We're going to talk with Jack, and we're going to talk music, punk rock, and while we do that, we are going to warm up with some more music. We heard Steel Leg versus the Electric Dread from the 1979 7-inch single on Version Records, kind of a one-off pill side project with Jaw Wobble and Keith Levine and also Don Letts. And speaking of Don Letts, we're going to hear from his documentary movie, Punk Attitude. But before we do that, just wanted to let you know this show, every show on the Fightin' Words Radio Network, is dedicated to the memory of the founder of Fightin' Words Radio Network, Bobby Carroll, who passed away in 2011. And we are here keeping the spirit of Fightin' Words Radio Network alive. Go to Google, search for Fightin' Words Radio, or go to iTunes Store, Fightin' Words Radio. You can connect with me, McGee, at D. McGurrigan on Twitter. And like I said, we'll be bringing Jack on in about 20 minutes. But in the meantime, we're going to load you up on some punk rock.
Culture, it changed my attitude towards what was possible. And I think I learned to go against the system a little bit.
Punk proved to people, and it is now ingrained in people, that what they thought was impossible is not impossible.
You didn't have to wait to start doing something. If you wanted to do it, you could try doing it.
Punk rock gave me a platform to put a band together and do it my way. And that was good for an 18-year-old kid.
Kids are still wanting the same thing as they wanted back then, something to express what they're feeling.
They get all this information from MTV and VH1, and that's their history of rock, and they find out that, like, well, it's like everything else. It's like school. You're not really getting the full story.
They were introduced to it as a package. They, you know, the business turned it into a commodity, if you will.
There's a lot of manufactured anger nowadays, if you ask me.
When you can make a dollar off it, it gets uploaded into the cultural lexicon. The slang becomes your normal patois of the day. You know, grunge becomes, you know, mom knows grunge now. As soon as mom knows how to say grunge, gotta go.
Back then, it was very much considered an anti-establishment, and it seems like today, most of the bands that do form want to be part of the establishment.
What they pay you for now is being stupid and making people stupider.
It's easy for a young person to say fuck you. I'm 43, I'm still saying fuck you. I'm still like pissed at something. You know, whatever you got, I'm mad at it. Where's the political awakening?
At this point and on the planet, it seems like 80% of the people are fucking asleep, you know?
Don't ask me why the cataclysmic state of the environment hasn't galvanize and, you know, mobilize people into doing something.
The more severe the political landscape becomes, the more repressive, the more valuable that the imagination becomes.
It's possible that music is not really the expression of it now, as far as relating to world, what's happening in the world.
People doing visual arts, people doing literature, it's people doing film.
You know, Michael Moore making that movie against Bush is really punk.
Punk definitely had a major influence in the eruption of militant anti-corporate activism that first came to light over here in the Seattle protests.
The actual whole internet is a very punk idea.
Because of the internet, the record companies are losing their power to be kingmakers.
You can go make your own records. You can go put them out yourself. You can build your own little websites. You can do all these things by yourself.
Fuck you to corporations. Fuck you to branding everything, and fuck you to corporations having dictatorial control over society and government.
Being able to look people in the eye and say, fuck you, I don't care what you think, I'm doing what I want to do. To have that to hold on to is really important to move forward.
And that's the whole idea, is to take the spirit and the inspiration and do your own thing with it.
All you need is one guy or girl to stand up and say, fuck this. And everyone goes, voice of a generation, thank you. I've been thinking that. I never had the guts to stand up and say it.
You only need 5%, you know, or less to, like, embrace ideas and change it. You know, change the way people think all over again.
It becomes a lineage. These people find each other and this timeline grows.
That song, John Lydon, the Rabbit song, John Lydon, singer of Public Image Limited and the Sex Pistols. Public Image Limited have a new EP coming out. It comes out this Saturday. It's called One Drop. And then their new album, the first in, like, I think 20-some years, comes out the next month. Yeah, McGee's Back Room. Tonight, special guest, very special guest, Jack Endino. The guy has recorded, engineered, produced, and mixed and worked on over 400 records. One of the records that Jack worked on early on in his career was released on Sub Pop Records in 1989, and the band, the album was called Bleach. Actually, let me see if the song actually... This would be apropos if the song's not there. And it's not. yeah, so the first Nirvana record Jack recorded. So legendary. That's stuff that's been covered in detail, other, you know, in minutiae for 20 some years now. So we'll skip the Nirvana stuff. We're going to go to next track, which is banned from San Francisco / Oakland. The band is called Carlton Melton, and this is their cover of Pink Floyd's song When You're In. You're listening to McGee's Back Room. And let me see. Don't tell me this song's messed up. All right. Now this song is it's going to be one of those nights. I can already tell. I see Deb is listening in. Hey, Deb, what's going on? Jack will be joining us in about 10 minutes. And right now, here's Carlton Melton. Thank you. band. That's the band Carlton Melton featuring Andy Duval, who is a regular listener to McGee's Back Room, and guitarist Rich Millman, formerly of the band Zen Gorilla. And we're going to be bringing on Jack Endino momentarily. But before we do that, let's listen to a track by the band Zen Gorilla. This is from their 2001 album called Shadows on the Sun, and the song is the lead-off track from that album called Barbed Wire. Came out in 2001 on Sub Pop Records, was recorded by our guest tonight, Jack Endino. So let's listen to this really, really killer Zen Gorilla song, and we'll get psyched up, and then we will talk to Jack about working with bands such as Zen Gorilla and whatnot. So you're listening to McGee's Back Room on the Fightin' Words Radio Network. Here is Zen Gorilla. Barbed Wire from their album Shadows on the Sun, 2001 Sub Pop release. So, been really excited to have our guest on tonight, Jack Endino. The guy is just, you know, if you go to his website, endino.com, check on his production discography. It is just like an incredible, you know, decades of working with some really, really amazing killer bands such as Green River, Afghan Whigs, Tad, Helios Creed, Helicopters, The Feeders, Seaweed, Blue Cheer, Zip Gun, Dickless, Reverend Hort Heat, Mudhoney, Green River, Nirvana, Therapy, Soundgarden, Skin Yard, Zeke, and the list goes on. Jack has worked on 400 plus records, so it's really just an amazing resume of punk rock and roll kind of history. So so Jack, one of the bands that you worked with was Zen Gorilla, and you know, one of the things that I, you know, preparing for the show, you said that you were really struck by Zen Gorilla's live performance, and I was wondering, like, hey, what you thought when you saw them, and then B, what was the challenge trying to take a band that was so powerful live and kind of make a record with them?
That was always the challenge with a band like that, is like going to the show and going, wow, how the heck am I going to capture this in the studio? You know, you can't take a band like that and sterilize it. You know, you don't put, well, I don't put anybody on Click Tracks, but you know, you don't over technologize the recording process if you can avoid it. You want it to sound good, but you want to maintain that vibe that they have. So ultimately I had to have them all literally standing in the same room, nose to nose, right there, and baffle it off as much as I could, so the mics weren't bleeding into each other too much. But basically, I don't even know if they used headphones. I think we set up a little PA wedge for Marcus to sing, and they just whacked through the whole thing as close to doing it live on stage as I could get it. And I have to say, it took me 2 albums to really get the hang of recording those guys. And the second record, the one you played, I think is the one where we sort of nailed it.
I agree. That second record is, in my opinion, their best record. But okay, so explain to people listening who may not have had the benefit of being in the studio. So, like, when you're a band in a rehearsal space, you are playing really close together and you're facing each other. And when you play live, it's a little different because you're facing outwards, you're facing an audience.
True, and you're a little further apart. But unless you're on a giant stage, it's still, you can hear each other fairly naturally. You want to hear the bass a little more, you walk a little more toward that side of the stage. You want to hear your amp more, you stand a little further back, closer to your amp, and you sort of tune it yourself. And in the studio, the thing is, if you can hear the other instruments, that means any microphones that are near you are hearing all the other instruments too. And the whole thing in recording is you want a little bit of separation so that the drum mic is not getting too much bass and the bass mic is not getting too much drums and so forth. Because the more that you have, the more you get phase cancellation and all sorts of acoustic muck that maybe you don't want in your recording. So it's always kind of a trade-off, is how do you get the live vibe but get a nice crisp sound? Because really, most live shows don't really sound that good. It's you're sitting there watching it. There's a visual spectacle. It makes it interesting. But if you just throw 2 mics up in a typical club and record it, you don't get anything that sounds like a record. It's usually kind of horrible. In spite of how good it feels and how great the band plays, it's recording a record is actually somewhat more difficult. And the key is not getting in the way of the band and not getting in the way of their whole organic kind of vibe with your studio technology. So Zen Gorilla they were a pretty good band, but that's kind of what I do. That's always been kind of my whole aesthetic, really, is capture the live feeling as much as possible on the record and don't sterilize it.
Does that mean that the bands that you work with, you go see them live beforehand?
If I can, I do. I don't always have the luxury. Like if somebody flies in from another country or whatever, then the best I can do is, maybe there's a YouTube video or they send me a rehearsal recording or something. But if it's a local band and I get the chance, and sometimes I like to go see them live before I agree to do the record, just to make sure that so I know what I'm getting into, and also just to understand what they're about. You don't get it from a demo tape, but maybe you go see them in a sweaty little club and you go, oh, okay, I see what they're trying to do here. And that sort of gives you an idea in the back of your head while you're making the record. How can I stay true to that so people won't hear the record and go, oh, it's good, but it didn't capture the live feel. You don't want people to say that.
Okay, so one of the things you mentioned that I wanted to talk to you about was Click Tracks. And for people who aren't familiar with Click Tracks, and I'm a drummer, so I know what they are, but in a typical recording scenario, a drummer will play to a click track in a studio. So that,
is this typical? I mean, I hear that it's typical, but I've successfully avoided it for 25 years, and nobody's complaining.
Well, for punk rock groups, I think it's atypical, but I think that the bottom line is, it's kind of the opposite of what punk bands and live bands are all about. That they, so I was just curious, like, you know, quickly explain what a click track is and like why you don't, you prefer not to use them or have avoided them.
Well, I've thought this, I have used them. I've been forced to use them a few times, and I've had a few clients who absolutely insisted on it, and I went along with it. And it's clear to me what the difference is between a band playing to a click track and one without. Here, the essence is a click track is like a metronome. It's basically, we call it a click track because that's the sound that you end up giving the drummer in his headphones. It's just basically a noise going pock, 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 like that. And it's, you know, it's in perfect mathematical time. And the idea being, you don't want the drummer to slow down or speed up. You know, we got to make sure that it's absolutely steady. So you make the drummer play along with this damnable noise that's going through his headphones. And some drummers get very good at it, LA session guys and so forth, professional session players and so forth. And various drummers that I've known are actually fairly skilled at playing with a click track. Now, the key thing here is that nobody uses them on stage, or at least very few people do. Most of the records from the early 70s and before that everybody idolizes as being the classic rock records were not made with click tracks. The drummer was the click track. The key here is that a click track is used, and it came into being in the late 70s, I think, and became popular in studio productions. Essentially, the only purpose of recording with a click track is to make a certain type of production technique easier for the producer, and that is editing bits and pieces of different takes together to make a composite take, and editing, you know, flying choruses around, moving verses around. What we used to do with a razor blade, cutting tape, you could take two or three different takes of a song, and you could say, I'll take the verse from take one, and the chorus from take two, and the ending from take three, and if all of them were done to a click track at the exact same tempo, then you knew that you could cut the tape right on the beat, on the downbeat of the chorus, and edit it onto the end of the verse from the other take, and it would all line up perfectly. You wouldn't hear any discontinuities in the speed. So basically, it makes things easier for a certain kind of production process for the producer. It has nothing to do with music.
Okay? That's like the perfect description, and I agree with you. It is, the goal is to make it easier on the guy who's making the record versus the band. And I think that bands who aren't experienced with playing to a click track and who are asked to, or
they usually sound terrible. They sound very stilted. The problem is it's natural. A drummer, and I'm a drummer myself. That was my first instrument. It's natural when you hit, fill, maybe it speeds up ever so slightly. You go to the bridge where the solo is, the song speeds up a little bit. You get to the third verse, maybe it slows down a little bit. The tempo breathes a little bit. And as a matter of fact, tempo, minute changes in tempo convey emotion. They actually are one of the ways in which emotional content is put across by the music, as well as getting louder and softer, you know, going higher or lower, singing harder or softer, timbre changes. You also have minute tempo changes that convey emotion. It's one entire dimension that you are removing from the music when you insist on putting everything to a click track. And again, now people do it in Pro Tools and in computers, and it's called a grid, where you basically have this like checkerboard thing on your screen and everything is snapping to the grid and you can fly stuff around all you want because it's all very easy. Now the thing is with software now, it's very easy to edit things without a click track. In fact, I do it constantly. And if your drummer is halfway decent, the speed variations are very minute anyway. And if the song is a little faster at the end than it was at the beginning, so what? Who cares? That's what music does. That's what music has done for thousands of years. So, you know, I could go on about this, but I've heard the difference. You'll get a take without a click track, and it feels very fresh and very natural, and everybody finishes it and goes, that was nice. You know, the drummer likes it. He says, that felt very natural. Then you make them do it with a click track, and everybody goes, this is so annoying. 'Cause, you know, and it's incredibly hateful. Now, if a band has only done click tracks, and I've worked with bands like that's what they have always done, and they it's like training wheels. As soon as you take the training wheels off, they start wobbling. And then you go, okay, you guys like the click track, we'll have to use it. But the typical rock and roll band, and for that matter, go back to the Zeppelin records, you will hear John Bonham speeding up and slowing down all over the place. Did anybody complain? No! So, you know, it's I mean, I've somewhat lost the battle because it's like everyone has drunk the Kool-Aid, but nonetheless, I have been recording for 26 years without using click tracks in my rock and roll records. Everybody compliments me on how nice the live feeling is that I get. Well, duh. So, you know, I carry on and I do what I do, and people seem to like it. So, but I've thought this through very carefully. You know, I've done it both ways, and every time I do it with a click track, I end up wanting to kill myself.
I agree with you, though, that okay. It is the drummer's
job. This is one
job.
Drummer to another, okay? Moving
right.
On.
So but the drummer, A, the drummer is the click track, and B...
Well, the drummer should be the click track, assuming he's a decent drummer.
Right.
Let him set the tempo and have him be done with it.
Right, right. Cool. All right, so our guest tonight is Jack Endino. Again, you can go to Endino.com. You can read about all the... Check out the... exhaustive kind of discography, and I mean exhaustive in a good way. You can also connect with Jack on Twitter at Endino. And Jack, I pulled a bunch of songs that you've worked on right now. And actually, you mentioned that you're a drummer, but also that you play guitar. And actually, if you will indulge me for a little bit, we're going to listen to a band called Candy Coated, correct me, you're still playing with Candy Coated, or?
Yeah, the band kind of fizzled about a year ago. I mean, we're all still on good terms, but we made our two albums, we did a bunch of touring, and excuse me, I have to cough, I'm going to put the phone away from me.
Sure, go ahead.
There we go, springtime bronchitis. It's pollen season in Seattle right now.
It's pollen season in Delaware, too. So.
Oh, God, I'm sure it is. Yeah, Candy Coated, we lasted about 3.5 years. We were on the Volcom Entertainment label, which the band Valiant Thor is also on that label. I got to do a couple albums for those guys. Wonderful people. You know, it was a pretty interesting time because I didn't expect that I would be in a band, you know, touring and playing again at my somewhat advanced age. And I had a pretty good time with the band, and we're all still in touch, and I still do some jamming with the drummer. In fact, he's going to be on my next solo record on a couple of songs.
Sweet. All right. Well, I'm going to – that makes me want to ask you about the solo record, but before we get into that, we'll listen to Candy Coated. This is Jack Endino's band that was active in recent years. This track is called Walk Away. So, Jack, if you will, hang on with
like
us.
Playing guitar. I'm playing the lead guitar on this one, which is much better known as a guitar player, I think, than a drum.
Are there any records that are out that you play drums on?
There's a band called Slippage that I played drums on a couple years ago, and we made a full album, and I'm the drummer on it. And but I mean, we only sort of released it ourselves, and I don't think it's on the internet. You'll never find it. And other than that, I don't think there's any recorded, other than my last solo record that I play three tracks of the drums, and my first solo record from 1989, I'm playing the drums on most of it. But there's not a lot of evidence, really. It hasn't been my main deal.
Right. All right, cool. So let's listen to Candy Coated. This is a track called Walk Away.
Staring at me over my fence. Ain't you got no goddamn sense? You better keep your distance. Loaded guns always cock my friend. My face, product of the human race.
Valiant Thor with a track called Habituary, and that is from a record that they did called Stranger. It was recorded by our guest Jack Endino, who has been making records and punk rock records, recording them, not actually making the records, but the band responsible for making and recording bands and mixing and engineering. And then before that, we heard Jack's band Candy Coated with a track called Walk Away. So, all right, Jack, so one thing I noticed in preparing for the show and kind of looking over your, you know, quarter of a century of making records, like the types of band you work with, like it almost kind of seems like the type, you know, the early stuff you worked on was, you know, it was heavy and it was aggressive, but it almost kind of seems like it's getting a little more aggressive and you're starting to work with even harder bands, and some of the bands are kind of metal, and you seem to have, like, I guess the question is, like, was it intentional? Like basically, how do you pick the types of bands that you want to work with, and like, why haven't you worked on records that are quote unquote more like commercial, or have you like declined those opportunities to do so?
Well, the main reason is I didn't move to L.A. in 1992, which would have been the smart sort of career thing to do. And the second thing is that I don't like those records. I don't like most of the commercial-sounding records. I've turned down plenty of sort of commercial-sounding bands, and so, you know, they quit calling me around 1995 because I always turned them down. You know, I ended up making records in other countries that were a lot more commercial, you might say, and a lot more sort of pop. I'm really a pop guy, and this is the funny thing, is that here in Seattle I'm known as like the grunge guy, the heavy rock guy, the punk rock guy. And if you go to Brazil, I'm like a pop guy. And so it's just a niche I find myself in. And as far as lately, the metal thing I've been doing lately, I like hard rock. You know, I have a soft spot for vintage metal. I'm not that much into modern metal as far as the really screamo thrashy stuff. It kind of wears on me after a while. You know, you'll notice some of the bands I've worked with in the past few years, like Early Man and 3 Inches of Blood, Valiant Thor. To me, they're rock and roll bands. I mean, people call them metal bands, but they're very sort of old school. You know, they look back on the 70s and the early 80s for their influences, and that's kind of when I grew up, so I can sort of get my head around that stuff pretty good. You know, High on Fire, that was a perfect band for me to record. I knew exactly what to do with that band, and plus the bass player, Jeff, was an old friend of mine. He'd been in Zeke, actually, who had recorded before. And Matt Pike, we had a lot of friends in common, you know, and I'd seen Sleep, and, you know, I sort of got the whole stoner thing was completely like, oh, this is what I was listening to in high school. Now they call it stoner rock. Half my record collection sounds like this stuff from the 70s, you know. So, you know, and I recorded Nebula in 99, and then that went on to do pretty well. And, you know, so there's always been a side of my career, which is like the heavy rock bands and some of the doom stuff and you know, sort of metal-y kind of stuff. And then there's always been the scary punk rock and the stuff like Zeke and the Load Levelers and the Murder City Devils. And then you got your garage stuff like the Makers and the DTs. And, you know, there's always, basically, you know, does it rock? Are there hooks? You know, are there actual songs? And, you know, because I'm even no matter how heavy something is and how aggressive and how punk or whatever you want to call it, I'm always looking for the hook. You know, will I actually like this music after I've been working on it for a week? You know, is there a chorus? Is there a song? Is there a bridge? I mean, are these good songs? Whatever style it is there a hook? Is there something that's going to stick in my head? Because if there isn't, I don't want to spend days and days in the studio hacking away at it. I have to actually enjoy it. So really, that's the criterion: is do I like the music? And my music taste is tilted toward aggressive, loud rock and roll for the most part. But you know, then again, one of my favorite records that I did was the first Mark Lanegan record, which was a very magical record that only took a few days to record. It just almost recorded itself. Everything just fell into place. It was like it was meant to be. So, you know, the stuff I've done is all over the map. And the past few years, there have been a little, it sort of comes in waves. I do one metal record and it does really good, so I'll get a bunch of metal bands for a couple of years. Then one year, you know, I'll do a band like Hot Hot Heat, which was in, I think, 2002 for Sub Pop. And that was kind of a vaguely new wave-ish kind of a pop band. And so I got a whole bunch of pop bands and, you know, a bunch of bands from Canada, which is where they were from, over the next few years. So, you know, and back in the early 90s, you know, I got, you know, Nirvana suddenly became huge, and I got a whole bunch of wannabe Seattle grunge bands. So, but, you know, you work with the good ones, and you turn down the crappy ones. my career just kind of rolls on, you know.
Have you ever gotten into the studio with a band that you realize is crappy?
Occasionally, yes. It doesn't happen that often because I'm very, the reason I'm still doing this in 20 years and after 26 years and enjoying it is because I'm fairly good at, it's, you know, sniffing out the good ones, beforehand and sort of, you know, going out of my way to become available for them and kind of not going out of my way to be available for the ones that maybe I don't think I'm going to like. You know, life is short, and you want to be around good music, and there's a lot of not very good music out there.
Well, people like you and I think, want to be around good music. I think there's a part of the population who probably, that's not an important criteria for them, but...
No, and there's a lot of music out there that really doesn't even register on my radar. You know, most of commercial pop music in the United States, not even, it just has no... anything for does has no meaning for me whatsoever. I don't listen to commercial radio. I don't pay attention to the charts. I don't even have a television, you know.
All right, so I want to talk to you about a band that was in, I believe, the late 60s, a band called the Sonics, and they're from Washington State. Where?
Tacoma, I believe.
Oh, right. Okay, so Tacoma. So Sonics, they had, you know, they're, and correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of, you know, that primitive, a garage rock band, had a really kind of raw, primitive sound. It was kind of based on the 50s rock and roll, but they kind of had this edge to it. And one of the things that struck me about the Sonics records, especially the way the drums sounded and how crisp and the snare drum and you know, if you listen to channels like Underground Garage on Sirius Satellite Radio, they'll play them a lot. And at one point, even one of their songs was featured in a car commercial, "How Love Will Travel." So this kind of underground, in a way, legendary band actually got back together and did some live shows. And, you know, it was kind of like 40 years after the fact. And then they went and recorded some new stuff, and they worked with you. And I was just, two-pronged question. A, what's your take on, you know, bands getting back together? And, you know, how were you able to connect with the Sonics and work on their new record with them?
Well, for one thing, I was thrilled to pieces. I was kind of born to record the Sonics, really. Because, you know, my whole aesthetic is you know, based on rock and roll. And, you know, these guys were almost one of the originators of it. I mean, they were considered one of the first punk bands in a lot of ways because their stuff is pretty punky. And, you know, 1965, you know, that's pretty early on, you know. So, and there, you know, a lot of bands from Seattle are sort of, you know, go back and examine the legacy and go, whoa, these guys were way ahead of everybody. So I was very sensitive to the idea that, okay, you know, here it is, 2010 or whenever we did this, and these guys are in their 60s, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, God, you know, I can't screw this up. Got to get this one right. You know, we have to make a good Sonics recording here, or, you know, this is going to be pathetic. Because, you know, as I said to them, I had a meeting with them, and I explained my whole philosophy, which they were totally in favor of, and I made a little demo CD for them of various things that I'd recorded, and the guitar player, Larry, he was kind of into it. He's like, oh, this stuff's great, okay, you know, we're in good hands here. And I said to them, look, you know, it's not 1965. You guys are older, and the recording equipment is all a lot newer. So, you know, there's a lot of factors here that just are not ever going to be the same, and we can't really chase those old recordings, which really, to me, sound like they were done with one microphone. And they reassured me that, no, we don't want to sound like we're recording in 1965. We want to make a nice-sounding recording that actually is, you know, where the instruments actually sound good. Nobody wanted lo-fi, in other words. They just wanted me to make a good rockin' recording that sounds like what they sound now. Luckily, the only non-original member of the band that I recorded, well, they had a certain auxiliary guy who did some vocals on a couple of tunes, and he actually is their live bass player. But they also had their original bass player come out of retirement for the recording. And the one key is they got the drummer who's been the touring drummer for the Wailers, who's like their sort of sibling band here from that time period that is still active. And he was, you know, he's like not as old as they are, but he's an older guy, but he's like really good drummer. Hard-hitting, rocking, everything I want from a drummer when they're in the studio. Because you can't get a good drum sound tickling the damn things. You got to hit them. So, you know, and the guitar player, Larry Paripa, still kills it on the guitar. He still had the same damn guitar that he was playing 40 years ago. It was this beautiful hollow body. I think it was an Epiphone. And just had a unique sound. And he came in, and I had this old Alamo tube guitar amp, and he plugged right into it and turned all the controls on 10 and went, oh, yep, there it is. You know, the amp was probably from 1963 or something. And, you know, at one point they had a fight in the studio, you know, and I'm thinking, God, they're just like teenagers. This is great. You know, and, but, you know, and then 5 minutes later it was all lovey-dovey again. And, we just got on with it. And we made what I think is a pretty good recording. You know, and they had a couple of good tunes, and I think that song "Cheap Shades" that opens it is sort of the typical hit.
Cool. Well, let's listen to that. But before we do, why do bands like get into arguments in the studio?
Well, two of them are brothers, for one thing.
Right.
So the
bass
same thing
player...
with the Screaming Trees. There were two brothers in that band, and it's basically the brothers. It's the brothers who always argue. You know, because they can. They're brothers. You know,
right.
I'm an only child, so I just kind of roll my eyes and go, oh, yeah, the siblings. That's what they
cool.
do.
All right, so let's listen to the Sonics' Cheap Shades. This was recorded in 2010, I believe. Jack and Dino, our guest,
yeah,
on McGee's Back Room. And then we will also listen to a Sonic song, one of their many hits from back in the day. Jack and Dino, if you don't mind holding on and hanging out
sure.
for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
We'll listen to some Sonics, and then we'll talk some more punk rock on McGee's Back Room.
You can wear them in the dark, you can wear them in the pool, but the most important thing won't get far. She's gonna make it live, 'cause she's no witch. When she walks around late at night, most of the people leave and pray. If you hear a knocking on your door, you better take it away. But you better be careful before it's too late. She's gonna make you ill, 'cause she's a witch.
Sonics with The Witch, and then before that, a track from their 2010 record that they recorded and made with Jack Endino, who is our guest. The song was called Cheap Shades. And Jack, actually, I was doing a little Googling while we were listening to those tracks. So the Sonics formed in 1963, and it's 2012, and I'm actually on their site right now. So they're tomorrow... they're playing, actually, it's, well, they're tomorrow they're in Brisbane. They're playing.
I was going to say, I think they're in Australia right now. So.
Yeah, they're playing with the Hoodoo Gurus, and then April 22nd, they're playing a festival with, okay, so it's the Hoodoo Gurus, Sonic, the Sonics, Red Cross, the 5678s, the Died Pretty, Flesh Tones, Tech and Younger, X-Radio, Birdman, Hard-Ons.
Okay.
I mean, it's
killer.
Just. Yeah, that is killer, and it's really amazing that a band like that, like you said, they're in their, some of the band members are in their 60s now, just still going at it, and, you know, what's your take on bands like that, or just band, punk bands in general, getting back together?
Well, if they don't suck, I'm all for it. You know, I mean, did you hear the Radio Birdman reunion record? It's awesome.
Actually,
It's called Zeno Beach, and it's killer.
Right. And actually, it's funny you mention that, because I did listen to that record the other day.
Yeah, give it a couple listens. It grows on you. And, I mean, if you go back and compare to their original two records, it stands up. I mean, it might be better. You know, Television got back together and made an awesome record in 1992. You know, you know, if people don't suck, if they do it for the right reasons, you know, I did a Feeders reunion record, and, you know, Frank Discussion is the only original member, really, but, you know, and I knew about the old stuff a little bit, and I said, look, you know, if you're going to do this again, you know, what was it, 15 years later or whatever, you know, we got to make sure this is, like, this needs to be as good as the old stuff. It's got to be good. It's got to be punk, you know, and we pulled it off. I'm not sure how many fans the Feeders have, but, you know, I felt like, well, you know, when you get one of those kind of jobs, you got to be careful, because you don't want to make the lame reunion record, you know, and sometimes people are not as good as they were when they were 18, but sometimes they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think in general, usually they're better players, because it, you know,
right.
Unless they've completely dropped the instrument completely.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's frequently true. But then sometimes maybe they don't have quite the passion that they had when they were young and had hormones flooding through their systems, you know what I mean? So it's but, you know, Soundgarden's making a new record. I've heard a couple of tracks, and it's actually sounds pretty good, you know, so that's, I don't think that's going to disappoint anybody. You know, I got to work with Blue Cheer in 1990, and that was a little strange, but I don't really want to go into that. I'm, God bless him. I miss Dickie Peterson. I'm sorry he's gone.
Okay, so, yeah, right. So you mentioned the Soundgarden record, and I guess my take on it is the worst-case scenario is you get back together and you put out a crummy record.
Right, exactly.
But
you're
going to
do that,
why
bother?
Well, but you still have those good records that you made if you're an exceptional band.
No, I know that, but what's the point of putting out a crummy record? I mean, what's the point of putting out a crummy record anyway, whether you're getting back together or whether you haven't broken up yet?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, well you know, don't.
Right. Well, I guess at that point...
It's easy for me to say that, you know.
Well, I guess at that point, if you've already committed to make the record and then you make it, then
yeah,
you kind of feel compelled to put it out. But I guess that's a quality control issue that you need somebody to kind of intervene and say, look, this isn't up to snuff or whatever. But I don't know. It's an interesting topic. And I think it's really cool that a band like the Sonics, and they kind of almost, you know, a lot of the punk bands that have gotten back together, it's been over the last 20 or 25 years. But the Sonics, I mean, that's a much larger gap to cover, but, I think,
yeah, I know. I don't think I'll ever work with anybody who started earlier than that. I don't think there's a lot of bands that started before 1963 where everybody's even still alive.
Right.
No.
Okay, so let's go back in the time machine a little bit before you were in the band Candy Coated. One of the bands that you were in was Skin Garden. You guys had
Skin Yard.
What did I say?
Yes. You said Skin Garden, I think.
Skin Garden. I'm looking right at it on my screen.
Yeah, yeah. But
Skin Yard, Skin Guard. Sorry about that. I know my history. but yeah, so Skin Yard, we're going to listen to a track that's a cover of the Damn song, Machine Gun Etiquette.
Oh, and, dear.
Why do you say oh, dear?
Well, because we did not take the song that seriously when we recorded it. I mean, it's a good version and all, but I mean, it was kind of it's a punk cover. Let's have a little fun with it.
Right.
And, you know, I would say it does not typify the sound of the band.
Okay. So
let's leave it at that. But hey, whatever. You
but
know,
hey,
it's,
you know what? But one of the things I was curious about was how you guys were into the Damned, and like, was it, were they like a big influence, or was it just kind of like, hey, this
no. Somebody was doing a Damned tribute compilation and asked us, hey, you want to do a Damned song for my Damned tribute compilation? And we're like, okay. And then that was like the logical song that I think a couple of us already knew, you know. And actually, it was a funny record. It was called Another Damned Seattle Compilation. It came out on a short-lived label called Dashboard Hula Girl Records that I think only put out that one record. There might have been another one, but, you know, this guy got the bright idea, let's do a Damned comp, and we'll get all these Seattle bands to do Damned covers. So the Accused are on there, and the Posies are on there, and Skin Yard is on there, and all these different bands are doing, you know, Damned covers. And it's a fairly interesting record if you can find a copy of it. So we took our Damned cover and stuck it on our own Rarities comp years later.
Right. Well, that's how I... you know, was able to track it down, and that Rarities comp is called Start at the Top, and
right.
We will listen to our guest Jack Endino, and Jack, you play guitar in Skin Yard, and so we're going to listen to some Skin Yard music, and maybe you can kind of catch us up to speed for those people who kind of Skin Yard may have flew under their radar, kind of what that band was all about. But McGee's Back Room, you can connect with Jack Endino on Twitter. You can find him at Endino, also Endino.com. This is Skin Yard with their cover of The Damned's Machine Gun Etiquette. And this song is really killer, and I think the version that you guys did really does the original justice. And even though you kind of are playing it down a little bit, I think this is a really killer song that lives up to the original.
One, two, three, four.
You're listening to McGee's Back Room on the Fighting Words Radio Network. Special guest tonight, and every guest is special on McGee's Back Room, but Jack and Nino is, yeah, of course, right? It's whoever's willing to come on and hang out and talk punk rock and make it records and stuff. So Jack was the guitarist in Skin Yard, and so that song started at the top. It was from Sub Pop single that came out in 89. It's funny, actually, listening to that, like that guitar solo, it kind of almost reminded me of the guitarist from Zangorilla and just kind of that unbridled, just kind of wailing, crazy, just really going off. And so,
it's actually, as I'm listening to it, I realize my Groundhog's influence is all over that track. Because
mm-hmm.
when I pick up a wah-wah, I think, well, how would Tony McPhee do this? but that's funny, because that's probably the most unhinged atonal guitar solo I ever put on a recording.
It's cool. Well, it sounds fantastic. Still some, but I guess I'm bad at math, so it would be 20, 20 plus years.
You're too kind.
Not at all, man. It's a rocking song. So what's the deal with the Skin Yard stuff? It's kind of somewhat hard to track down.
Yeah, you know, it got so that it was down to the point where I was like selling CDs from my website, because I was able to. Some of the records went into cutout bins, actually, and I was able to track some of those down and get a bunch of them for almost nothing. So I was selling those, and some of the early records are out of print. Daniel, of course, put out the first record on his label. Daniel being our bass player, Daniel House, he put out the first record on his label, so we still had that one. The second record came back to us after a certain period of years, and, you know, we just kind of couldn't get around to doing anything with it. And we finally got off our asses, and I remastered a bunch of it, and, you know, we were putting it online. So we should have been a little more proactive about it, but, you know, life got in the way. So the stuff is mostly going to be available online fairly soon, I think.
Sweet. And that would be from the usual suspects?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, whatever it is, it's all remastered by me. And even some of it remixed. There was a couple that I went back and revisited and went, oh, I could do much better now. And I did.
Are you able to make, when you remix something like that, I mean, I know the remastering process, but are you able to make a significant difference when you, like, remix something?
In some cases, yes. There's certain things that I completely didn't touch because they were, no matter how low a level of technology I was using originally, I felt like, okay, mission was accomplished here. This still sounds good. And there were a few things that I thought, you know, this never really was very good, and we didn't have enough time or the gear. Now, here's the thing. When I was recording most of that stuff, it was the late 80s. I'd only been working as a recording engineer for 2 or 3 years or less. And, you know, now I've been doing this for 26 years, and I have much, much, much better equipment available to me. You know, the studio I work out of has a lovely old Trident console. You know, I just basically, you know, you do get better after you do this for a while. I'm finally starting to get good at it. And, you know, sometimes I pull up old recordings, and I've revisited a few other things that I've dealt with over the years that maybe I recorded 20 years ago, and I pull up the faders now, and I go, oh, I see exactly what to do with this. And, you know, in about 5 minutes, you've got a better mix going. So sometimes it's easy to improve something that maybe you didn't have enough time to devote to originally. And other times, you can't touch it because there was something that was just magic about it, and you have to leave it alone. And the key is knowing the difference.
All right, so our guest tonight is Jack Endino. Again, go to Endino.com. Check out, and just the discography is crazy. And as I was preparing for the show, I went through the discography and kind of revisited several times. And then I realized it's part of the discography. Then there's like a separate section.
For singles.
For singles.
Yeah, I know. I haven't updated that in a long time. People quit making singles in the 90s, and suddenly they just all dried up. And, you know, I realized that I hadn't added anything to it in like 4 or 5 years, and so I quit looking at it. And I realized I actually have a growing pile of singles now that people have been making in the last 5 or 6 years that I've, one way or another, I've ended up recording. And so I need to add about 20 more singles to that at some point. Also, you know what? The album discography is not up to date. It goes to about sort of 3/4 of the way through last year, and I've got a stack of CDs here. There's like 10 of them that I need to add to it. Like, for instance, Black Tusk is not on there.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Tusk is on Relapse, and they're out touring as we speak, and they're this great band, sort of punky metal band, actually. And I had a really good time doing a record for them that came out toward the end of last year. It was called Set the Dial. And I just in my hand, and I just haven't gotten around to putting it on my discography. And then you've got Snowbud and the Flower People, which is actually the official release date is tomorrow, 4/20, as it so happens. And that's from Portland. And, you know, that's like an extremely significant record because guitar player Chris Newman used to be in a band called Napalm Beach, which was one of the bands that Skin Yard opened for on one of our very first shows in 1986. And, you know, 20-some years later, I got to record his latest band, and it was killer. He's one of the lost guitar wizards of the Portland rock scene.
Hmm.
You hear things about Portland, you think the Wipers, but then you've also got this other guy, Chris Newman, and his various bands.
Huh. And what was the name of his old band again?
His original band was Napalm Beach, who I wish had a chance to record back then, but I never got a chance to. They made a lot of cool records that weren't recorded that well. And, you know, and it's, he's a bit of a guitar god. I really respect him as a player, and it was a pleasure to finally get to record the guy 25 years later. So, you know, and the record's called Flashback by Snowbud and the Flower People. You should look for it. It's only, like I said, the official release date is tomorrow, but, you know, I'm kind of stoked that this one's coming out. And then Black Tusk, that's a killer record. If you like Tie and Fire and you like Zeke and you like all that stuff, you'll like Black Tusk.
Right. Well, actually, we're gonna listen to a song by Black Tusk, but...
you knew about it. It wasn't on my discography, but you found out.
Hey, man, I do my homework. Good Where man. Are they from?
God, it's North or South Carolina or something, or maybe it's... Geez, I could be doing them a disservice here because it might actually be Georgia. I'm kind of blanking on that. It might be, where the heck are they from? You know, I don't remember.
Right.
It might be Atlanta or something, you know, whatever. Well, they're from the other side of the country.
Right. Well, I'll look on Google Maps for them. But yeah, this is Black Tusk, a record, recent record that Jack, our guest Jack Endino, recorded. This song is called Bring Me Darkness. And remind me again, what's the name of the album's called Set the Dial, correct?
Set the Dial, yes. Set the Dial to Your Doom.
All right, cool. All right, our guest is Jack Endino. Do you mind holding on and hanging out for a little
sure.
bit longer?
Yeah,
all right. Sweet. I appreciate it. Again, go to Endino.com, connect with Jack at Endino on Twitter. This is the band Black Tusk with the ominously titled song Bring Me Darkness.
Come on.
Now, how could you not love that song? That's Toxic Holocaust with their track War is Hell from the album An Overdose of Death. And then before that, we heard Black Tusk with a song called Bring Me the Darkness, which very emphatically in the beginning of that song says 666. So you kind of know where things are headed.
Oh, yeah, of course. You tickled me playing Toxic Holocaust there. That was a nice surprise, because that was a really enjoyable record to make. It was made very quickly and very painlessly. Donnie from Zeke actually is the drummer on there. He was sort of the guest session drummer. And as soon as you hear those drum fills, that snare roll, I'm thinking, like, that sounds like Zeke. Oh, it's Toxic Holocaust, of course.
Yeah, and I'm a huge Zeke fan, and I know that you got to work with them, too. And they...
Two albums.
Yeah, they just... that band, I never got to see them live, and I'm hoping that at some point I can remedy that.
They are doing shows now. I mean, the thing is, they don't tour the way they did, but they're doing, like for instance, they just went and they played for the first time ever in Hawaii, you know, and everybody brought their wives, and, I took a little vacation and played a couple of shows while they were at it. And, I think they went down and played South by Southwest. I mean, they are playing, but they're just not, like, doing the full-on, tour for 6 months out of the year thing like they used to. They've all
right.
got, like, families and kids now.
And that's probably, that's the more sensible way to do it. And I suppose when you're a younger band, you do have the time and the energy that you can go out for 3-4 weeks at a time and zip all throughout the U.S. But, practically speaking, it's not the, especially the way the U.S. is spread out. I mean, it's not the most...
No. It's not that easy to tour in the U.S.
It really isn't.
Any band from Europe who comes here realizes that very quickly as soon as they do the 33-hour drive from Seattle to Minneapolis or something, you know what I mean?
Right. They'd say, well, why do we book this again?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, again, Jack Endino is our guest. Go to Endino.com. I implore you to check out his impressive discography of...
I better update it.
Well, please, without, even if it's not updated, I mean, it's just
an incredible
number of bands and records that you've worked on. So,
you're just lighting a fire under my ass here. I guess I go put 10 more records on that discography. No, I need to do it. It's like the bands I recorded at least deserve me putting them on there. You know what I mean? Deserve
it. Okay. So one thing that struck me about your website is it's pretty... and I'll use that word again, exhaustive, but just there's a lot of detail on there, and a lot of, like, people who make records won't even bother, like, putting all that information out. And I was just curious, like, what your philosophy is and kind of, because you'll talk, like, you'll get into some, like, pretty technical details on, like, making some of the records, and just curious, like, why you make that stuff public.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder if I shouldn't, if I should keep it mysterious and just have a website with my picture on it and a contact, and maybe the discography and leave it at that and have it be like a little bit of mystique. And I thought, screw that, because people write me all the time and they want to know stuff. And this back in the 90s when I first started doing the website, a lot of my time was spent answering people's questions who write me, and they go, well, fans of various records I've done. Well, what amp did you use? What mic did you use? How do you like to record? Blah, blah, blah. And there's certain questions that I've answered over and over again a million times, and I started saving the answers, and I realized, here's the frequently asked questions thing, because I am frequently asked certain questions. And believe me, that section of my website has headed off a lot of my time being wasted by people looking at it and going, oh, here's the answer right here. I don't know. I have to admit I haven't added to the website terribly much in the last decade, but, other than keeping the discography up to date and a few things like the contact info and so forth, if you look at it, it does not look like a modern website, but the information is there. And, I really don't care about the rest of it. I'm not going to put a bunch of flash animation on it or anything.
Please.
I want the information to be easy to access. I want it to load quickly if you're using some old computer, you could be using a phone line and my website will still come up immediately. So, and that's for the people in other countries who might be looking at it. Not everybody has a broadband connection. And
right.
I've worked in 11 countries, and there's people all over the world who might be interested in reading it. So I've kept it very simple.
All right. So, Jack, let me ask you this. So, you know, you're pretty immersed in music. What do you do to get away from music? Or when you put down music, what do you like to do? Because you said you don't have a TV, so you don't?
No, I do not. I haven't had a TV since 1974. You know what I do? I get out in the woods. Any chance I get, I am out in the trees, hopefully far from a city, but I'll settle for like large parks or whatever I can get. I'm outside as much as I possibly can be, like whatever time I can spend away from staring at computer screens. You know, today it was funny. We have a big park here called Discovery Park. It's a former military base that was turned over to the city of Seattle many years ago. And I think it is technically the largest park that's inside a major city west of like the Mississippi or something. It's enormous. You can walk there for a good 2 hours. And, you know, it's all woods. There's a beach. There's a lighthouse. There's all this forest and there's fields and there's all kinds of stuff. And what did I do today? I went for a hike there at like 9 in the morning with a portable recorder. I got this little Tascam, like portable little flash memory recorder a little while ago. It's like $50. And, you know, it holds like 2 hours of audio and has two little stereo mics on it. It fits in the palm of your hand. And I thought, this is interesting. What can I do with this? So what did I do? I went out today and I was recording the birds. Always on the job, I am, I guess, you know.
Seriously.
So I thought, I'll try this thing and see how it works in nature. And I brought it back, plugged it into my computer, and it sounded killer. Kind of funny, you know, so realizing, well, okay, once an audio geek, always an audio geek.
Yeah, really. So that really doesn't answer the question, what do you do to get away from...
to get away from recording, I know.
Right.
Well, you know what, I work on tube amps. I'm a tube geek, so I'm always like, I've got a little table and I'm always soldering something together. And, you know, hacking away at old vintage electronics, mainly tube stuff, that's a kind of a fascinating subject for me, old tube compressors and tube guitar amps and such. So that's a hobby, is tube amps.
So what's distinctive or about a tube amp versus, and as a drummer, I plead ignorance about how
they're like old cars. You can work on them yourself. It's like an old pickup truck or something where you can climb under the hood and like change the manifold and, you know, change the timing on the spark advance or whatever. It's all like you can literally do it all yourself. You don't have to have like some expert do it for you. And that's what old tube amps are like. You can literally say, well, what if I change the bias on this tube? Well, I'll swap the values of these capacitors here and it'll change the sound of the EQ on the amp. You know, they're very DIY, you know, and, you know, it's a perfect sort of hobby thing. There's modern equipment, you know, it's all like microprocessors and semiconductors and circuit boards, and you can't do anything with it. It breaks. You pretty much have to throw it away. So, you know, that's where that's at. It's fun. I'm a tweaker.
All right. Right. Sounds like it. All right. So wanted to step back in the time machine a little bit and actually if you'll indulge me, play a couple tracks that you recorded from some Sub Pop bands in the late 80s, and this one might even be from the 90s. The band's called Rain Sanction, and kind of in the like grand scheme of things, I feel like they totally got lost and kind of, you know, I know one other person who's really into this band, but, you know, in preparing for the interview, I saw you talking about, and kind of what you mentioned earlier on about working with Zangorilla is like trying to capture their live sound. And I was just curious if you remember at all, you know, what it was like to work with them to make that record. I think it's called Mariposa.
Yes, the Rain Sanction record made in Jacksonville, Florida. Only time I've ever made a record in Florida. Yeah, that was another case of, like, get out of the way and let them rip. Because if you listen to the record, you find that it's very, very improvisational. There's a structure there, but the whole thing is very loose, and you have to kind of listen a couple times to sort of see what exactly is going on. It's a very psychedelic record, and they were kind of a very psychedelic band, one of the most psychedelic bands I've ever worked with in every sense of the word. So, you know, that was a hard one. That was a case of, like, capture it before it gets away. And the band was sort of volatile. They didn't really last. I mean, they actually only made those two records on Sub Pop, and Sub Pop dropped them. Nobody really went for it. But it's kind of a cult record, actually. So people who discover it are like, what is this band? And they did manage to make one more recording a few years later, but the band had gone through some changes, and it didn't, I had nothing to do with it, of course, but it didn't really capture the magic. And I don't know where they are now, you know? There were two brothers in the band, actually, and another
right.
of siblings. And they were a crazy bunch of guys. Nice people, though.
Yeah. All right, cool. So we're winding down the show, but let's listen. Like I said, Jack's going to indulge me for a little bit. We'll listen to a couple of my favorite tracks that I've pulled out for the show. Again, go to Endino.com. You can check out Jack's work, connect with him there, follow Jack on Twitter at Endino. This is the band Rain Sanction. And I saw these guys live, and they just blew me away. And
wow.
Such a great live band to see. And I think this recording captures some of that essence. Rain Sanction with This Town.
Oh,
That's L7 with their track Shove. And I remember getting that Sub Pop 7-inch in the mail and just loving that song. And the way, Jack, man, the way the guitars, the introduction, that kind of riff, and then the solo, like, just, it's sick. It's really cool.
Kind of grungy, isn't it?
I try not to use the G word on the show, well, just because
it's really just, it's all just rock and roll to me anyway.
Very much so. Very
people
much
call
so.
It whatever they want to. It's all just rock. But yeah, that's a nice surprise. I haven't listened to that L7 song in a long time. I think that actually became one of their best known songs, even though they ended up on a major label and made a couple records on Warner's or whatever. That song from the Sub Pop record that I worked on, I think it ended up getting used in a movie or something, and I think probably ended up getting heard more than most of their other stuff did.
Yeah, well, it's that's definitely, like, for me, that's like their hit song. And I mean, I guess it's cool that a band like that ends up on a major label, but I don't, you know, in the long run, I don't know that that was like the right place for them. But
no, it didn't make any sense at all. But, you know, they had a little run for a couple of records and people heard the song Andre a little bit, but, you know, but they never really, I don't know. Most of the bands that ended up getting signed to major labels for brief periods in the early 90s ended up making really bland records. But that's, you know, I would say that.
Yeah, why is that? Why did, because it wasn't that the bands that the band was bad or whatever, but I agree with you that they did kind of make some, there was something off about a lot of those records.
Yeah, I know that. And, oh, we don't have time for discussion.
I know, that's for a different show. Our guest tonight, Jack Endino, again, go to Endino.com, check out the discography, and we're going to close out the show. I tracked down one of the songs from Jack's solo record, and the album's, I believe, called Permanent Fatal Error, correct?
Yep.
And
it's my third solo record. I put it out about, 2006. Roughly, and I'm almost done with another one right now. But
really,
story. Yeah, got another one in the can, almost ready to go.
Sweet. So, if and when that record comes out, where can I find it? Where can we point people to track it down?
I have no idea.
All right.
I have not grappled with that issue yet. I'm not sure just exactly. You know, everything has changed now. You know, back in 05, I made 2,000 CDs and mailed out a couple hundred as promo, you know, and we got a little very limited distribution. Europe took a few hundred of them. And, you know, I sold them on my website and put them up in CD Baby and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I've got a couple hundred of them left, but I got rid of most of them. And now it's like, well, I wouldn't do that. Nobody
right.
wants to buy a CD. So I'm not quite sure exactly how the heck to promote anything anymore.
Mm.
You know, MySpace was kind of rolling back then, and now you wouldn't even touch it. So, you know, what do? Bandcamp, Reverb Nation? I'm not quite sure what to do, really. So I'll cross that bridge.
Cool. All right, Jack, man. You're really great, guys. You can come on anytime that you want. Keep you posted on the new record. Hopefully, when that comes out, we can reconnect. And again, people go to Endino.com, keep track of what Jack is up to, and follow Jack on Twitter at Endino. Anything else before we sign off?
Yeah, is your show archived in some way that people could go and listen to it?
It sure is, yeah.
I was not smart enough to, like, point people at this beforehand.
Correct.
I totally slipped
And I will post that on your Facebook page and also send you a link. And people can go to McGee'sBackRoom.com. They can also go to the iTunes store and search McGee's Backroom, Jack Endino, and they'll find it that way. But I'll be sure to send you a link,
oh,
all right?
Good deal. Yeah, then I can tweet it after the fact.
Sweet. You can tweet it. All right, Jack. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for hanging out.
Thanks a lot.